From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. These days, the Chinese artist Ai Weiwei is known for his social activism and his criticism of the Chinese government, so it would be easy to lose track of the actual art he creates, which is pretty expansive. There's architecture, like the Bird's Nest Stadium he designed in Beijing. There's photography, there's sculpture and epic installations like a massive bowl of pearls or an exhibit that included 100 million porcelain sunflower seeds. Ai Weiwei doesn't seem to make much of a distinction between his art and his politics. The filmmaker Alison Clayman followed him for 3 years, a time when his dissent in China was reaching a fever pitch. The film premiered at Sundance this year. It's opening this weekend here in Utah. Today in the program, Clayman will be among our guests to talk about the life and work of Ai Weiwei. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. People wondered when it would happen, when the artist Ai Weiwei would get arrested by the Chinese authorities. For years, he had been escalating his criticism of the government, and observers figured it would just be a matter of time. In April of last year, it happened. He was detained for 81 days. In her documentary film, Alison Clayman documented the years that led up to that moment. The film's not just about Ai Weiwei's activism, but also about his work, which has always blurred the line between politics and art. Ai Weiwei's work includes architecture. The Bird Nest Stadium in Beijing is his design, but there's also photography and sculpture and provocative installations involving twisted furniture and millions of painted porcelain sunflower seeds in one case. Today in the program, we're profiling Alison Clayman's documentary. It's called Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry. The film premiered at Sundance, where it won a special jury prize. It's opening in Utah this weekend. We'll give you details about that and where you might be able to see it in your area a little bit later in the program. You can join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Alison Clayman will be with us a little bit later in the program. First, we're joined by Mika Yoshitake, an assistant curator at the Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden in Washington, D.C. The Hirshhorn is opening an exhibit in October that's going to feature a survey of Ai Weiwei's artwork. And for details about that, you can go to our website. We'll mention that. She's joining us today from the studios of NPR in Washington. Mika Yoshitake, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I guess I wanted to start maybe for those who are not entirely familiar with Ai Weiwei's work. Let's talk a little bit about kind of the scope of the work, which seems really remarkable and in some ways kind of hard to pin down. I mean, you know, there's photo installations, as I said, and architectural projects and murals. And is there anything that ties it all together in some way? How do you describe his work?
Well, Ai Weiwei is definitely an artist who encompasses a lot of territory and intersections. And this is, you know, everything from his individual experiences growing up in China, and also very internationally. He moved to New York when he was in 1983, and also lived there for 10 years and experienced a lot of contemporary art firsthand without the kind of mediation, you know, normally allotted by artists. And so in a way, his kind of lexicon is a very kind of it integrates many aspects and cultural contexts. So he does use a lot of broad spectrum of media, including sculpture, photography, video, site-specific architectural installations, as well as exploring many universal topics, culture, history, politics, tradition. And you know, he's also kind of made a name for himself, not only as an artist, but as an activist. And so I would say the kind of thread that pulls him together is this multi, as a very transnational artist, a multi faceted figure.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about the exhibit. It's titled According to What?
Yes.
Which is taken from the name of a Jasper Johns painting.
That's correct.
It's interesting because, as I understand it, earlier in his life, he had kind of the same questions about art that some may have. That is pop, you know, modern art, those kinds of things. Like, you know, how can a flag or a soup can, how can that be considered art? I mean, but then he came in contact, as I understand it, with Jasper John's work, and it seemed to have a powerful influence on him. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, yes, Jasper John's painting, specifically this 1964 painting, which is called According to What, was in a way his entry into the contemporary art world. And when he first encountered it in the early 80s, I think he definitely was not sure of what to make of it. It is a very large panel painting that has a very inspirational element to it that's Duchampian, and a kind of compendium of a lot of different motifs that Johns has used throughout his career. And the real, I think, point is that, you know, the title, According to What, it's a question. And that's a kind of interrogative attitude that that Ai Weiwei has always, I think, valued in contemporary art, which is how to frame or how to contextualize meaning in the world, and how to also deal with reality, especially in terms of his experiences within the communist state and through the Cultural Revolution, and and coming to a country where there's, you know, it's democracy. And I think it was a very refreshing kind of attitude to look at, you know, what we see every day, like flags, beer cans, targets, and question what, even though it's so obvious, these kind of symbols, what that means semantically in everyday life, and to kind of have a distance and to bracket those motifs from everyday life and to see it again. It's almost like defamiliarizing what you've already seen or experienced.
How is his work? We'll get into this when we talk about the documentary, because you get a sense of the way his life is evolving. But
right.
How is his work changing or evolving, do you think?
Well, I think that there have always, in the early days, the exhibition that we'll be having at the Hirshhorn really begins in 1983 with his documentary photographs and him really being more of an observer of the everyday. And, you know, when he was living in New York, it was a very fraught period with the Tompkins Square's Square Park riots, as well as the AIDS crisis. And, you know, I think he was always tapped into this how politics can, we as individuals can affect change. And I think it was very refreshing to see just everyday people, you know, protesting, and to be able to make some kind of comment on life. And that, I think, has carried on through to this day. And, it is much more complex and serious situation in China. So in his work, he was, you know, working in very different kind of media, from photography, went into also, you know, small sculptures, and using a lot of appropriation, which means borrowing, kind of found objects, ready-made objects, like, for example, Qing Ming Dynasty temple fragments, and combining them using these very traditional joinery techniques and making them into these huge, large-scale installations, or, you know, creating these very minimalist forms using, but yet using these, culturally specific wood, or things from his childhood memories, like these bars that he was using in the park, and kind of combining them with wood, or stuff like that. So there were a lot of these sculptural pieces, but then his work has developed over time. He started working in architecture, and of course, one of his most famous works is The Bird's Nest with Herzog and de Meuron. And recently, The last third of our exhibition will really focus on his investigation of the Sichuan earthquake, which happened in 2008. And there were many thousands of lives lost, especially school children. And there's an issue of the architecture being very shoddy. And so he started to compile all of the students' names. And I think that there is part of that Allison does show in her film, that process. And so the exhibition will include some of the documentation, but as well more abstract installations that are stem from that experience.
Well, Miki Yoshitake, stay with us. We're going to bring Allison Clayman into the conversation now.
Sure.
Allison's film is called Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry. It's showing in Salt Lake City starting tomorrow at the Broadway Center Cinemas. As I said, we'll give you the details about that. Allison wrote, filmed, directed, and produced the documentary. And she's joining us today from NPR's studios in New York City. And Allison Clayman, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited about this weekend's opening in Salt Lake City, because the first time I showed the film publicly was actually out there at Sundance.
Yeah.
So it really, I'm sure a lot of filmmakers have that feeling, but it really feels like a homecoming in
good.
My mind.
Good. Well, I guess the obvious question is how this all started for you. And you've talked about the fact that in some ways it was just kind of luck. I mean, you had gone to China. I think this was 2006. You said you really didn't know much about Ai Weiwei at the time. And I guess it's one of those stories you sort of stumbled upon in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely a situation of the right person, you know, having the right intentions, meeting, you know, being lucky enough to meet an opportunity to fulfill those intentions. I really did have a dream of doing documentary film and certainly freelance journalism when I went to China after I graduated from college in 2006. And it was really, to anyone who, you know, knew me at the time, it was certainly the most random decision I could have made. And I went there on a few month trip that really turned into a 4-year stay and, you know, ended up resulting in this feature documentary. I met Ai Weiwei in 2008. So as you can see, it was something where I think it was just the right time. I was already, proficient enough in kind of speaking Mandarin by that time and was just getting a journalist accreditation. So I felt like I was really about to embark on doing the kind of work that I wanted to do. And, in the meantime, as I waited for that visa to kind of clear through the foreign ministry like system, my roommate said, you know, I'm working on this show for Ai Weiwei, and it would be really great if we had a video to accompany the show, but nobody's doing it. Would you want to come around and help us out? And I jumped at the chance. And for me, it was really meeting Ai Weiwei in person was what really sparked the idea for this film. It felt, you know, so obvious. It felt like this man just deserved a 90-minute film. You know, it was both by all the questions that he inspired in me that I wanted to know more, and also the force of his personality. I think, you know, anyone feels that when you watch the film. It's, you know, it's really a pleasure and a challenging experience to spend that time with him.
How do you – so I guess you encountered the man himself. What about the art? I mean, what kind of impact did that have on you wanting to tell the story? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, for sure. The way that I really got to know him before meeting him in person was actually through his body of work, the New York photographs. So for months, these photographs, and he took about 10,000, and Mika alluded to them, these sort of documentary photographs from the decade that he lived in New York in the 1980s. He took thousands of images, and they were lying around my house in binders for months before I was sort of brought into the project, because my roommate Stephanie would bring them home and kind of look through them, and so would I. And I think that is what originally kind of captured my imagination. And what I always think is funny is now this period in his life is much better understood because of these photographs, and they kind of place documentation and photography, you know, kind of they put they kind of show the emphasis of that practice within his larger art practice, thanks to kind of getting to know those images and, of course, all of the history that it contains about that time in his life and also just that time in New York. And so, you know, for me, these were totally, you know, my, you know, entryway into Ai Weiwei. But it's funny because that was kind of before the world really got to know this body of work. And, you know, it's just, I think his commitment to, and I just wrote it down because I really liked what Mika said, kind of being an observer of the everyday. And the fact that doing that diligently over a long period of time and then looking back on those images really produces something worthwhile, you know, because I feel like Weiwei describes it as at the time as being a very offhanded kind of gesture and, you know, kind of impulse and not thinking of it certainly as art or even necessarily thinking that they were particularly important. But now, you know, I think they're important to a lot of people and they really meant a lot to me. And so I think, you know, that was the initial kind of grab for Weiwei's art, and the entire process of filming as I got to know him and, of course, got to see all of the kind of dramatic things that happened to him in the last few years. I think I also had the pleasure of kind of unveiling his entire prolific, very, very prolific body of work as well, because it wasn't all known to me. I didn't come to this as, you know, an art history student who had studied him. And so every work that I learned about, you know, I was blown away by how much he's done, and also just how intelligent and precise and somehow managing to be precise and mysterious at the same time so much of his work is.
You know, it's interesting, the climate and the way the sense of foreboding kind of builds in the film as he gets more and more, I don't know if aggressive is the right word, but certainly more bold. And one of the things, there's this moment in the film where I think it's you who is asking him how it is he's so fearless, which is, you know, you're essentially trying to get from him, aren't you afraid? Because it seems like it would be really scary to be doing some of the things that he's doing. Talk about how he responded to that question. You asked him, how it is he's so fearless.
Sure. And, you know, and the funny thing, too, is that that particular moment was within the first or second week of knowing him, actually. And that was from one of those conversations when I was supposed to be talking to him about his New York photographs, which I did as well. But that made me think, God, there needs to be a longer film in here because, you know, there's all this contemporary stuff that seems incredibly vital. When I asked him, you know, how is it that you're so fearless? Because all he would talk about battling the censors, you know, on his online and how, you know, he's not going to give up and they have to understand that about him is incredibly bold, you know, attitude. And he said, I'm not fearless. I'm so fearful. But, you know, that is what makes me fearless, maybe. It makes me act more brave because I know the danger is really there. And you know, he's saying essentially the danger is not just to others. It's coming to me as well. And so if I don't act, the danger becomes stronger. And it's really this imperative for sort of individual responsibility and individual courage. And I really think the individual is so much at the heart of both his art and his activism. And I think why his story is also so inspiring to people around the world.
Because you ask him to describe what kind of an artist he is. And he says he's a chess player, which was so interesting that he put it in that way, that he was playing against an opponent in the scheme of things.
I know, and it also gives you a little hint at how, you know, how tricky it can be to get a straight answer from Ai Weiwei. The fact that actually that was me filming another camera crew asking him that question. Huh. But it's because he's someone who gets interviewed so much, and I thought it was actually a really kind of a bonus, a benefit for me to watch him answer so many other people's questions. But that day, his answer was yes, that he's a chess player, and it's about, you know, making a move and then his opponent making the next move. But you know what? That's honestly really how I view the events of the last few years, like how he's come to be the sort of iconic figure that he is, and really essentially what the plot of Never Sorry amounts to. It's really about action, reaction, reaction, reaction. And I think that's one of the biggest characteristics of Ai Weiwei that makes him, you know, a really unique figure is that he really doesn't back down. So the game is so the story keeps going because these efforts to silence him or intimidate him, you know, he will always respond back. And I also, by that same token, I really think that he, in that sense, not to take any like agency away from him, but in that sense, he's not solely responsible for his fate either. I mean, and the status that he currently has, you know, domestically and around the world, it's absolutely, you know, it's a joint creation between him and the authorities.
Alison Klayman is with us. Her film is called Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry. It's showing, as I said, in Salt Lake City, starting tomorrow at the Broadway Center Cinemas. For showtimes and to find a screening in your area, visit our website, kuer.org/Radio West. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling the artist Ai Weiwei. It's known for provocative installations, distorted furniture, piles of sunflower seeds, defaced ancient pottery. His work blurs that line between art and politics. He's also China's most outspoken domestic critic. There's a documentary created by Alison Klayman that's opening in Salt Lake City this weekend. It premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. And Alison Klayman is joining us to talk about it. We also have with us Mika Yoshitake. She's an assistant curator at the Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden in Washington, D.C. There's an exhibit of Ai Weiwei's work opening there in October. 801-585-WEST, if you'd like to join us, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So, Alison and Mika, I wanted to talk about how Ai Weiwei comes to his art. And you have to talk about, Alison, we'll start with you, as you explore in the film, you have to talk about his experience with his father and his life in Northwest China, where his family was exiled. He lived there for 16 years. Talk about that and the influence it has on his life.
Absolutely. You know, he had from a very early age a very clear picture of the power that the state and the system can kind of enforce over an individual. I mean, he grew up the son of, you know, one of China's most famous modern poets. He was, a celebrated cultural figure who had fought valiantly for the communist revolution, you know, studied abroad in Paris, you know, had traveled, was friends with Pablo Neruda. Mm. I mean, he was truly a man of the world, but who also believed very strongly in the communist cause. And in the late 50s, as happened to many sort of intellectuals and cultural figures, he fell prey to Mao's kind of campaign of disingenuously letting people speak out, 100 flowers bloom, and then turning on those individuals and, you know, labeling them rightists. And his father was sent into a sort of domestic exile in far western China, and that's where Weiwei grew up. I mean, he was born and immediately, you know, taken off into this situation. And he grew up seeing his father, you know, treated essentially as an enemy of the people. You know, he had but a few of the possessions that could remind his family of his former life, you know, and the objects and the books that he cared about. And then this was their situation when the Cultural Revolution came in the 60s, and he suffered tremendously at that time as well, and worked as a toilet cleaner. So for Weiwei, I mean, I just always think about the sort of disconnect between knowing kind of what your father, you know, was and stood for and was supposed to be, and kind of the reality that he was living day in, day out. And I know it was incredibly hard on his father as well. So I think, you know, growing up in that environment, I think it's also that conflict between understanding that you have a father who cares very much about culture, about creating new culture, about the, you know, the traditions of Chinese art and writing, and but again, transforming it into something new, or carrying it on. And yet, you know, living in this environment where Weiwei always talks about, you know, he was not educated, and you know, it was sort of a very backwards looking or destructive kind of an environment to grow up in.
Mika, there's a you see this, his kind of regard for, or the way he's considering objects in a lot of his work. I mean, and there's, I wanted you to talk a little bit about Allison, you know, goes to this idea of how the importance of antiques, or how they're very symbolic for him, and this attempt then to Mao's attempt to destroy the past. And there's this expression of it in these photos you see of him, you know, smashing these vases, crushing this really valuable pottery. I wanted you to talk about that element of his work.
Yeah, I mean, there are, I think that's a very, very strong aesthetic that he deals with, which is basically, you know, mimicking this sense of destruction and almost creating this clean slate that the communist state tried to instill onto, you know, the masses. And yet in that sense of kind of destroying the in a way, Ai Weiwei, what he does is he destroys the functionality of, for example, some of the furniture fragments that he uses and makes them into different, you know, non-functional cubes or moon chests or, you know, maps or, you know, just they become these, you know, they're not part of everyday life anymore.
Yeah.
Yet parts of it still have that. I mean, his work really deals, I think, with memory and you know, with a lot of the, for example, these, there's a work where he uses temple fragments. And when you think about a temple, it's a place for you to kind of, you know, meditate and think about where you are in the world. And I think that in a sense that there is some of those, you know, the residues of those fragments or those part objects that are still instilled in his work. And so... Yeah, I mean, in a larger political sense, I think he's grappling with this kind of contradiction of trying to completely, you know, the devaluation versus also evaluating the past. Mm. And there is a part in the exhibition we're dealing with called Reforming and Inheriting Tradition. Mm. And it's kind of investigates the artist's iconoclastic approach to accepted values of historical tradition and also questions of authenticity and originality. So, and that the latter, you know, questions of authenticity and originality is something that also carries through in other artists, contemporary artists' works. It's a kind of historical trope of modern, of post-war contemporary art.
Mm. You know, Allison, I kept wondering if you know, you go to his house and you talk to him there a number of times. But I kept wondering, does he keep antiques? Does he keep objects? Does he put any certain value on, you know, collecting certain things? Does he have a sense of sentimentality about that stuff?
Well, sentimentality, you know, that's been a question that's come up a lot in Q&As recently. And I do feel like he is, on the whole, not a particularly sentimental person. But actually, when it comes to these objects, you know, I have to say there were a lot of scenes that I did film that didn't make it into the movie with Weiwei either, you know, collecting himself, you know, looking at old objects, going to kind of dealers or sources that he clearly has a relationship with and kind of looking at what they have that's new. And the way that he handles, in this one scene we went to an antique shop in Shanghai and looking at these jade kind of, they were, I don't know enough even to really know what the purpose of these objects were, but they were so gorgeous. They could fit in your hand and like carved so perfectly. And Weiwei, actually, I would almost say was a little sentimental about, you know, the care with which, you know, thinking about who had made it so long ago and how much effort they had put into it and how beautiful the jade was. You know, he was also himself a dealer in antiques in the 90s as he was kind of finding his way as an artist and also just kind of to make money. It was a business he had with his brother. And that's partly, I think, where some of the kind of artworks where he's dealing with antiques kind of come from. I also observed, you know, in New York, him visiting, a very prominent, Chinese art kind of dealer gallerist of antiquities, J.J. Lally, in his sort of showroom. Weiwei could go around and look at the objects and immediately say, you know, what era they were from, or it looks like you rebuilt the lip on this one. I mean, things like, I mean, I'm certainly not the most trained eye, but I was blown away by how much knowledge that he has. And I really think a lot of it is kind of self-taught from the time that he spent, you know, looking at these objects and kind of studying them, revering them. And so actually, you know, I think he, it's that kind of, it's that, you know, age-old thing where, you know, an artist, you know, moves away from convention, but first, you know, kind of masters it before you can move away, or you have to kind of be able to do the portrait before you go off and you make the very abstract work or something like that. And in Weiwei's case, I think he has an incredibly educated kind of and very trained eye when he looks at these objects.
Well, if you contrast that with what something that his brother had said when he left to go to the United States, that he pretty much didn't take anything. He just wanted to get out, and he wanted to go. And I guess he sort of came back around to thinking differently in some ways. But this sort of leads us to his life in the United States, particularly which you profile, Allison, in the film, his life in New York. Mika was talking about, you know, he arrives there, I think it's 1983, and there's all this stuff going on. He's on the Lower East Side, and he goes to these museums. Allison, talk a little bit about the influence that New York has on his perspective.
Well, I once said to him, I really wish I could have met you back then when you would have been so wide-eyed. And, you know, just like I imagine it as kind of just gobbling up contemporary art, you know, and modern art. I mean, really, you know, at this point, I think he does kind of know so much about the background, and he is so focused on his work in China that I think his attitude would be in stark contrast to how at least I imagined him based on his description of his time in New York. And it was about, you know, he'd spend hours and hours, especially at the Met. And I went to the Met with him in 2010, and he also was he had me walk with him through the African art section as well. And, you know, he was just interested in, and he said he always used to come there and just interested in all kinds of inspiration and all kinds of traditions. And really, you know, I also kind of picture him, and there are some photos in his, you know, thousands of images that he took, you know, at the hot galleries of the time, like Mary Boone, who now, you know, has had, you know, several shows of his work. But at the time, I picture him as, you know, the guy lurking outside who, you know, he was not a famous artist and he was not recognized. He was working, and he did have his work shown, and he worked with the Ethan Cohen Gallery and had a show, I think, in 88 around then. And he was doing lots of interesting stuff, but it's just that wasn't his moment, and it wasn't the sort of Chinese contemporary art kind of moment like it is now. And, you know, when he describes that time in his life, he really talks about it as doing nothing, which, again, if you look at these photos, I mean, he was doing everything is probably a better description. You know, he was an extra in the Metropolitan Opera. He was, you know, taking photographs of protests and contributing to, like, every newspaper in the city. He was helping out other Chinese expats, you know, get the lay of the land, or even shoot a television show, you know, that aired back in China. I mean, he was really, you know, he was and going gambling all the time in Atlantic City. And so, he really lived it up is really how I see it. And I also like that the way he describes it, though, is kind of doing nothing, because in a way, I think that's I believe very strongly that it's important to have times in your life where you're doing that kind of nothing. And I think it really did help him, you know, for an artist to have such so many years to really be thinking and experimenting and experiencing, I think it, you know, has to have contributed to why his work is so smart and so kind of well thought out.
Mika, talk about some of that early work. There's a piece that we see in Allison's doc about, I think it's called Hanging Man, and it's basically he's manipulated this metal
profile of Duchamp.
Yeah, it's Duchamp, it also has the sunflower seeds in it, which I think is interesting if you think about the fact that he'll come back to that object. Mm-hmm. But talk about that early work.
So that's from 1983, and it's called Homage to Duchamp. It's just a clothes hanger that he's bent into the shape of the profile of Duchamp, and he had sunflower seeds basically just in the portion of the face. And Duchamp was a very inspirational figure for him, and the sunflower seeds, you know, basically the symbolism is that during the Cultural Revolution, it was often said that, you know, Mao was the sun, and so that the Chinese people were like sunflowers turning towards him. Mm. And so he really employed this motif from early on, and also, you know, the profile of Duchamp throughout, I think, this period. We were talking about Ai Weiwei being sort of just describing himself as a chess player, but I think that also, you know, comes back to Duchamp's, this kind of trickster, and not knowing exactly what, there's no single, you know, message or meaning in the work, but it can be taken in many different ways or variety of ways. And so it's just, you know, very ephemeral and also yet very poignant work that I think is great. But, you know, I also wanted to mention, I mean, there were some things that we were discussing, you were talking about as far as his experiences in New York. So right after New York, he went back to Beijing in 1993. And Ai Weiwei really also, his role was to disseminate a lot of what he had learned in the U.S. And he actually published three books, which were illegal. They're each called the Black Cover Book, the Gray Cover Book, and the White Cover Book. And it really introduced the experimental art practices of young Chinese artists, as well as translations of texts by leading Western figures such as Duchamp and Warhol. And I think there were only 3,000 copies. It was an underground edition. And it was very powerful influence for the Chinese art world. And so I think his role, not only as an artist, but just as in terms of, you know, creating a groundwork for Chinese artists to work, you know, internationally was very significant.
You know, Allison, and someone says in your film that his concern in those days, you know, returning from the United States, was about art. You know, it was about the art world. But then he begins to change to where he starts to think more and more about social issues, more about politics. Is that how his life and his work is evolving?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's clear that he's always been an engaged and opinionated kind of figure from the very beginning. And I don't see it as maybe as much as, you know, that inside changed so much. But I think it's that he found a way through his actions and his work to really be able to engage with the biggest issues that are relevant to his daily life and his society's, you know, kind of current, you know, the current mood and the current politics and the current problems. And that was really by, you know, discovering the internet, as I like to joke. In 2005, Ai Weiwei kind of discovered the internet. He was invited to have a celebrity blog on Sina.com, which is one of the main kind of web sites in China. And he decided that he wanted to try his hand at blogging because he sort of saw it also as a chance to try to write essays regularly and that, you know, to see if he had any of his father's talent for writing. Yeah. And I think that in my mind, it has not supplanted creating art, but it has sort of enhanced the work that he's doing because it allows him to engage very immediately, to disseminate very widely, to get reactions from readers very quickly and to also be engaging another audience that may not be getting to see his work in a museum setting. And that's also that's especially the domestic audience. Mm-hmm. You know, he writes and he blogs and now tweets in Chinese pretty much exclusively, which I think already kind of tells you who his primary audience is. But if you think about it, that's also the audience that doesn't really get to see his work in person because mm-hmm. he doesn't really get to have shows in China. And so, again, I don't see it as kind of replacing his concern, you know, or his desire to exist within the art world, but I think it's kind of in addition to. I think, you know, as he kind of settled back into his life in China, it also makes sense that more and more he got back into the swing of things of kind of not feeling like he was newly returned and kind of lost, but feeling like this is his place, and he's kind of stepping up to, you know, the mantle of being kind of a public intellectual. Mm.
You know, it did make me wonder how much, like if other artists or observers in the art world were worried that he was going to, in some ways, maybe even stop doing the art that he had been in, you know, because he was such an activist. And I wonder how has this activism changed his art? And in some ways, is anyone talking about it as maybe potentially a limitation on his creativity, on his art? Mika, what do you think?
I'm not sure if I see what you're saying, but I would never think that it's a limitation on his art. I mean, there's so many different capacities in which he can take this, and he's also, you know, from his blogs, he's such a, I would say, almost like a poet or a philosopher, and so it's just one means. Even his activism, I think, is just one means yeah. of trying to create some kind of, you know, a change in terms of this, you know, the system within China, and especially, I mean, he's obviously targeting specific issues like human rights and freedom of expression, and I think those are universal, and it cuts through, you know, within the art community. And I mean, I don't think that you can necessarily separate it as finely as you know, one would think. So,
Allison, what do you think? It's probably.
Well, I'm thinking back to, you know, interviews I did with others. I definitely remember. You know, people definitely noted that, you know, that it's sort of like his dance card gets a lot fuller. I mean, right. When you spend a lot of your day giving interviews and, you know, which I think he does find something important about it, or he did, you know, in the years that I was filming him, you know, it takes a lot of energy. You know, he's giving a lot of himself, and it also is a lot of his time. Mm. Now, fortunately, his work is also produced in a way where, as he says in the film, he's kind of more like directing it, and it is produced by so many different people and artisans and you know, traditional craftspeople. And so, you know, it's not like if he's not sitting at the, you know, at the studio, you know, work table, it's not getting made. But it does kind of, you know, he is finding himself not only stretched more for time, or he was, and also, you know, the more he kind of flirts with disaster, the more, you know, the more people are concerned, you know, that you know, him physically, and also even his art, you know, are not allowed to travel. I mean, so there definitely are ways that it can kind of interfere. But I agree with Mika that I don't really think it's kind of, I don't think that having that kind of impetus within him to be speaking out and be expressing himself online and being an advocate for freedom of expression, you know, I felt after several years of following him that it all very much comes from the artistic impulse, comes from what he sees as his role as an artist in his society. And, you know, I think it's all part of the same kind of project. So in that sense, I don't think it really conflicts.
Allison Clayman is with us. She's a documentary filmmaker. Her film, Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry, opens in Salt Lake City tomorrow. Mika Yoshitake is an assistant curator at the Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden. And we need to take another brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the artist Ai Weiwei. We're talking with Allison Clayman about her documentary film, Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry, which is opening in Salt Lake City tomorrow. And we're also talking with Mika Yoshitake. She's an assistant curator at the Hirshhorn Museum. There's going to be an exhibit there in October. I wanted to get back to the sunflower seeds, because it's one of the exhibits. It's at the Tate in London, Allison Clayman, that you profile in the documentary. There's something that Karen Smith says. She's this writer and curator in your film. She talks about how really his influences relate to it's the social, it's the individual. This is something you were saying earlier, that this is about the individual. And it made me, and I wondered if that's what you're seeing in that reflection of these, I guess it's 100 million porcelain sunflower seeds. Is that the significance there, that it's about the individual?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are many different kind of references that you can make. And that's what I think is so beautiful about Ai Weiwei's art, you know, fine artworks as a whole, that might be different from, let's say, a very bold and strident, you know, soundbite he might give or a tweet that he might put out. I think that there is a lot more kind of ambiguity and things that can be read into his work, and the sunflower seeds are like that. But I was just editing, working today and yesterday on some of the DVD extras for the film, and looking back at him being interviewed on the sunflower seeds, about the sunflower seeds, by many different British journalists. And that is for sure one of the things that he talks about, where he says, you know, these works, they're all made by, you know, one individual person, because they're all handmade, hand-painted. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, maybe these might even be the smallest sculptures that, you know, that ever were, you know, existed and exhibited. But that, you know, once you, what does it mean to have all of these totally unique objects and to suddenly have so many of them, you know, all together, and how that can create a perception maybe of, you know, there's two different ways to take that. One is that it kind of erases the individuality. Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of our perception, it's harder to see the individual when it's in this sort of this mass. But by the same token, the idea that just one particular seed may not be the most impressive kind of thing you've ever seen, but that collectively coming together, there can be a much greater impact and a greater meaning. And so I think, you know, that's something where he also said to me was, you know, this idea, it's like having one tweet and, you know, sending it off into the world. Mm-hmm. But when it's like tons of people, that there's a movement there, when it's like, you know, one person expressing themselves times, you know, a million, 100 million, you know, what is the possibility there?
In April of 2011, of last year, of course, he disappeared. He's detained by Chinese authorities, it turns out, for 81 days. And I wanted to ask you, Allison, how you reacted to that time when he was gone. I mean, everyone was wondering. His mother, you know, people didn't know where he was. There was some question about, was he, you know, was he still alive? Where would he be? How are you reacting to that?
Oh, my God. I mean, hands down, it was the most scared I was during this entire process. And as you see in the film, I mean, there are some scenes going to the police, and I was there, you know, along with the group kind of filming. But hands down, the most scared I ever was for those 81 days. And I was sitting, you know, in relative comfort in New York, editing the film at the time. But, you know, I was pretty much glued to Twitter the first few weeks, definitely. Also Skype, because many of the people kind of in his world and in his studio were being constantly brought in for questioning, and people would check in with me just to kind of, you know, our Twitter account for the film was kind of keeping a lot of the news current and putting good information out there. And I was talking with reporters back in Beijing all the time, which again shows you how kind of murky information is from, you know, within Beijing, to have people who are right there in Beijing needing to call someone outside to get, you know, to verify things or to suggest things, but it was because that was a story they all knew I had been following for a long time. I mean, it was a very scary time because we really feared, you know, the worst being some kind of, you know, political charge with a very long sentence attached to it, kind of coming down the pike. And it wasn't clear where he was. And also, you know, and then on a personal and by comparison kind of trivial level, I mean, it was also, I was speaking out a lot about his situation. I even, you know, went on the Colbert Report. I mean, crazy things that I was, you know, I was working on a film that was not yet finished. So I wasn't really ready to kind of come up in front of people. And it's certainly, I'm used to being on the other side of the questions and the camera and all of that. So it was also on top of it all, it was, you know, kind of more than it was putting me in kind of a new position, but I definitely felt like it was a, you know, what would Weiwei do kind of moment. Yeah. And I felt like on that front, at least I had probably the best PR training for the last 2 years, watching Weiwei kind of speak out for others and, you know, give countless interviews. And so that was, in a nutshell, those 81 days from my perspective.
Let me ask you this finally, like 30 seconds left, but did you worry about him? I mean, what's so interesting in the film is we see him when he comes back, and he doesn't seem afraid, but he won't speak at first, and that really worried me. I wonder, did that worry you?
Yeah, I mean, it did worry me, and I would have to say that I'm still worried for him.
Yeah.
In a way, I wonder if I was ever not worried for him. I mean, I think it's the kind of thing where we always knew the risk was there in what he's doing and in this context that he lives in that really has no good rule of law and no freedom of expression kind of protections. But, you know, right now I think his situation is precarious and perhaps, you know, even worse than it was, you know, certainly hasn't changed since he's been released. And in that sense, I think understanding his story better is even more vital.
Alison Clayman, documentary filmmaker. Her film is Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry. It opens in Salt Lake City tomorrow. She joined us from the NPR studios in New York. Alison, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
And Miki Yoshitake, an assistant curator at the Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden, joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Thanks to you.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.